This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And the first half of our show today, we are visiting with Foster Campbell, the ranking public service commissioner elected in 2002, a man who's been in public life in Louisiana as an elected official since being elected to the Louisiana Senate in the year of 1975. And we want to cover some ground with Foster Campbell. And before we get to his main topic, which is climate change today, Foster Campbell, you, of course, knew Edwin Washington Edwards well. When you were elected, he was starting his second term. And through the years, you became a very good friend. Your thoughts about his long and interesting life?
That's a good way to put it. He had a long and very interesting life. He was a friend of mine. I liked him. I knew he had shortcomings, but I don't know anybody else that doesn't have shortcomings. He was very smart guy. One thing about Edwin Edwards that everybody liked, even his enemies that served in the legislature with him, he'd call you back if you had a problem in your area. You know, politicians get problems. People walk in every day. For a senator, they walk in every day. They got a problem here. They got a problem there with the various towns and all. And you could call Edwin, and he would call you back. He was great at that. He would call you back and give you an answer. He didn't have a long time to talk to you. I don't think he wanted to talk all day. He was not a guy to do that. What's on your mind? Let me see. I'll call you back. He'd have somebody call you back the next morning. He was great about that. I'm forever grateful to him up here in Bossier Parish. Edwin Edwards named this fund up here I have called Beef Bossier Educational Excellence Fund. We saved all the money from the gaming proceeds and the racehorse proceeds. Today, the beef program in Bossier Parish has $60 million in it. Nothing like it in the country. I don't believe nothing sure in Louisiana. $60 million in an endowment fund that can only spend the interest in the classroom. You can't buy football, basketball, or baseball. It can't go to teacher salaries. It has to go to classroom activities, and Bossier Parish schools have done very well. Bossier Parish is growing faster than any parish in Louisiana, maybe with the exception of St. Tammany or someplace like that, but it's doing well. And when the tobacco settlement came along, you remember a lot of people didn't want to sue the tobacco companies. Mike Foster didn't want to sue them. John Kennedy didn't want to sue he was working for and Bobby Jindal didn't want to sue them either. You might remember that. But we sued the tobacco companies. We should have sued them. We got $4 billion settlements for all the problems they caused us in Louisiana and all the expenses at the charity hospitals. But anyway, I was able to take $1 billion of that and create a statewide program like the beef program. But Edwin Edwards really helped a lot of people. I know he had some problems, but like I say, he helped a lot of people. He had a heart for working people. That's where his heart was, people who, blue-collar people that sweat and make a living every day. He was on their side unequivocally every time that he could help, he did. So, like I say, I know he had some problems, but he was a man who served the people well. And he was on top of things, and you could talk to him. That was the main thing. And one other good thing about Edwin Edwards, I never heard Edwin Edwards, he wasn't a real mean guy. He didn't want to take it out of your hide. A lot of governors, if you don't vote with them, man, they want to veto everything you got and take it out of your hide, you know. He wasn't like that. You know, if you couldn't vote with him, you know, he'd just say, okay, get you next time, and go on down the road. And that's a good way for politicians to be. If you can be that way, I'm not that forgiving. I wish I could be. But I never heard him talk about people badly or, you know, certain different legislators. A matter of fact, I mean, Woody Jenkins was never a friend of Edwin Edwards. But I never heard anyone ever say anything bad about Woody Jenkins. I think they spoke and they were pretty cordial. Woody never was on his side for us helping him pass anything. But I don't think Edwards ever really had a great dislike for him. I never heard of it.
Well, I know Woody occasionally would have Edwards to Woody's house on Foster Drive. So that shows you those were different times, though. Today, the battle lines are drawn.
I know that, but that's I didn't know that, but I'm glad to hear that because that's the way it ought to be. I mean, we ought to be able to disagree without cussing everybody out and you know, storming the Capitol and breaking out all the windows and kicking out all the glass. I mean, it doesn't have to do that. We can disagree and get on down the road, but that's not what's happening today. It's a line drawn down the middle of the road, either on the left or the right. And if you're on one side and I'm not on the other, we're not friends. We're enemies, and we're going to fight to the end. And that's what's holding the whole country back.
Now, Foster Campbell, you're a survivor of both polio and COVID. And right now in our state, 64% of the people have not been vaccinated. That's almost two-thirds of the state. What is going on?
I don't know, but it makes me sick. It makes me sad. Anybody that is listening to this broadcast, I had COVID. Let me tell you something. It's not easy. I had it about 15 days. I was sick. And when I got out of the hospital, I didn't go to the hospital. When I got off the sick bed and I had a chance to take these shots, I took it. I remember as a kid, they used to line us up. I mean, in the third grade, and everybody took a little deal of sugar for a cube of sugar. All the kids in the school got lined up and to fight polio. Why would anybody not take these shots? I don't understand that. Please take the shots. Man, I mean, the people who are dying, they're still dying, and you're not taking shots. It makes no sense. Well, it doesn't matter if it's a Republican deal or a Democratic deal. How crazy is that if you've got a vaccine that works? You know it works, and the people are dying, 98% of them or 99% haven't been vaccinated. Why would somebody not get vaccinated? I cannot believe that. And our state probably leads the nation in that. If not, or some other state, Mississippi or wherever, I don't know, maybe New Mexico. But, man, if you have a chance, the shots are free. Take the shots. Absolutely take them.
Tyler Bridges in the latest Advocate, he questioned our congressional delegation. And as we know, Steve Scalise just got his shot last week. But three members of our congressional delegation, Garrett Graves, Mike Johnson from where you are, and Clay Higgins, who's had it twice, declined to answer if they had been vaccinated. And I think by declining to answer, we kind of get an indication of the probable answer if they were to reveal it. Why would members of Congress, of all people, not get vaccinated?
I have no idea. Just crazy. I mean, that is crazy. This boy Johnson up here is right down the line with Donald Trump. If Donald Trump told Mike Johnson to jump off the Mississippi River Bridge, he would be walking up there to jump off. Unbelievable. And this guy's a lawyer. He knows better than that. It's just playing politics. That's all it is to it. But what he's doing is have an example. He's causing people great harm. I mean, he knows better than that. But I'm telling you, if Donald Trump told Mike Johnson to jump off the Mississippi River Bridge, he would do it. Unbelievable. The people up here, you know, that he represents, he's what's he trying to say? Oh, well, there's some people who don't believe in it. I don't want them to think I'm not a Trump believer or whatever. I believe Donald Trump has killed a lot of people in the United States of America by all this foolishness that he put out, that it's the flu, it's no big deal. And you know what? This is just me talking. I think if Donald Trump would have told the truth, which is very hard for him to do, but if he'd have told the truth and told the people, look, we got a serious problem here in America, and I'm up for election, but I'm not. Look, let's forget about the election, but let's take care of people's health, and we're going to get a vaccine, and y'all get vaccinated. If he'd have done that without all the baloney that he came up with, he'd have got reelected. I think that's what beat him, because he kept lying and lying and lying about, oh, the shots don't this and that. But he got one.
Yes, he did. And
he went on and on about how this is the flu and drink this and drink Clorox and drink this and drink that. And you had a doctor up there. This other guy from Kentucky is just as crazy as Mike Johnson, whatever the senator's name from up there.
Rand Paul.
Crazy. Absolutely nuts. I saw him on television. You know, they arguing with this man that we have. That's the doctor that
Fauci.
Is helping
Fauci.
Arguing with this guy. This guy is very well respected, very well known, doing the best job he can do. And you got people in Congress arguing with this guy, confusing the facts, where we ought to be united, telling the people the truth. Look, please go get your shots.
We'll be back after this 90-second pause with more pearls of wisdom from Foster Campbell. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Foster Campbell, public service commissioner from Northwest Louisiana, but spends much time all over the state, and he is here to talk about matters that he finds near and dear. And for years, as we know, Foster Campbell has been pushing for a processing tax on oil and gas. It was something that originally was proposed by none other than David Connor Treen, Republican governor of Louisiana, in his only term in office, the Quell tax. And so far, the votes have not been there. But Foster Campbell trudges forward, and he says that there is information that is now corroborated by The Guardian, one of the leading newspapers in the world, that oil and gas companies knew for years that climate change was affected by emissions from these gas-guzzling vehicles. Now, Foster Campbell, is this the kind of the smoking gun we saw with the tobacco industry? What do you make of this?
Well, I think it is. It's very shocking. We got a copy of the article. They said in the 80s, Exxon knew about it, and they just disregarded it. In other words, not just disregarded, they preached against it. When somebody would come up saying we're going to have climate change, you know, they made fun of people like Al Gore. Al Gore talked about this in the 80s or 70s, and people laughed at him about it. And Al Gore was absolutely right. He won a Nobel Peace Prize with his commentary that he came out with, or his movie. We've laughed about it in Louisiana. You know what's amazing? I saw some statistics the other day. We look up the poor states in the United States of America, and the poorest is Mississippi, and then guess what's next? Good old Louisiana. We're the poor state in America. We've had all the oil and gas blessed with it. I've been blessed with it in my backyard, the Haynesville Shale. My whole farm is in the middle of it. I've been very blessed with it. But we've had all this oil and gas coming through the state for years and years and years, and we've let the oil companies treat us like a third world country. How could Louisiana be broke with the blessings that we've had with oil and gas and the Mississippi River? It's just one pure fact. This is a fact. The oil companies in the past and now own the politicians. And when they own the politicians, anything you do that's going to cost them money, they're against. If you want to talk about global warming, they make fun of you like they did to Al Gore. Just like Bobby Jindal last time, he passed bills that you can't sue the oil companies when you tear up the coast. How crazy is that? You tear up the coast, we lose a million acres, and Mr. Jindal is in the shirt pocket of the oil companies. He wants to make sure you don't sue him because he's running for president, and they're mighty powerful. Tell the truth. Get the politicians to tell the truth. Oil companies are not going to leave. We have the Mississippi River. They can't move it. We've got the refineries. They can't move them. No other states want them. We know how to do it. Dave Treen was absolutely right. Dave Treen is the most honest governor that we've had in Louisiana. Dave Treen, very, very honest. He tried to do it with this quail tax. And guess what happened? They left Dave Treen. All the business people left him, and they went back to Edwin for a reason, because they knew Edwin wasn't going to pass his oil and gas tax, excuse me. Treen tried, and they beat him. So, I mean, don't tell me about the lobbies of the world and how they're all for all the Republican, and it's all conservative, and it's all lily white and all good. Good example. What did they do to Dave Treen? Dave Treen was too good. They didn't like him because he was going to make them pay and clean up the coast and help us preserve our coast. No. They beat Dave Treen. So what we have in Louisiana is a lot of politicians, the major politicians, are in the pocket of the big oil companies, and they've sold the people down the river. We're broke, we're dirty, and we're compared to Mississippi instead of states like Texas and Tennessee and Florida. What are we doing? We're begging people to come back to Louisiana, and we're a dirty state, and we have problems with our education and roads and things like that. And anytime a politician wants to touch the oil company and raise a little tax, you're going to run them out of the state. Unbelievable.
Garrett Graves, congressman from Baton Rouge, he says we can have big industry and also address climate change, that it can be done together. Is that a dream, or is he on to something? Are you being too harsh, Foster Campbell?
Well, I'm glad you brought up his name. Mr. Graves worked for Mr. Jindal, if I'm not mistaken. I think I'm right. I'm absolutely sure I'm right. And Mr. Graves was right in there with Mr. Jindal when you didn't want to sue the oil companies. And so one night at LSU when I was there, Mr. Graves was talking about coastal erosion. But 6 months before, when he was working for Mr. Jindal, he was not wanting to ask the people who caused it to pay for it. So I don't know about Mr. Graves. I mean, I hear both sides of Mr. Graves. I've got one side that tore up the coast and he supported it. And 6 months later, he's for fixing the coast. So I don't know. But I think whatever he's saying, that we ought to be able to work together and have industry in Louisiana and have climate change to correct the problems we have in climate change, I agree with that. But you're going to be able to have to tell these companies, you're going to have to pay for some of it. You can't just put it all
in the state. You say Louisiana could raise over $5 billion every year with this processing tax. Now, how in the world would that be practical?
It would be practical because you'd pass that fee or the $5 billion that we would get from the offshore oil. First of all, let's just talk about that. That Exxon refinery that you have in your backyard in Baton Rouge, everybody knows, and by the way, they've given a lot of great jobs. I'm all for that. But they wouldn't move it. So, I mean, the people in Baton Rouge has done great for Exxon, too. They've given them all kind of exemptions year after year after year. But they provide a job. But so what? They needed Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge needed them. We don't need to be used by Exxon. We need to have an agreement that's fair. It hasn't been fair in the past. Today, that Exxon refinery in Baton Rouge refines 98% foreign oil, 98%, and 2% Louisiana oil. And we tax the 2%. And nobody wants to talk about that. We can change the way we tax, but it takes some politicians with some courage. You have to change the Constitution. And we ought to have a session to do that. John Bel Edwards ought to be out there leading a fight for that and get those people to come in and say, okay, let's make a deal. Let's take this money and we'll work together and we'll fix the roads. We'll fix the highways. We'll fix the education. But you can't do that in Louisiana because the legislature is subservient to the oil and gas industry. Now, here's where the mule jumps the fence right here. The oil and gas industry is changing because now we're having we're going to have wind power. We already have wind energy in Louisiana coming up from Kansas. We're having solar power, and oil and gas is going to be less and less important in the future. There's going to be a place for it, but there are places for renewables. People don't want to deal with it, but you're going to have one right over New Roads. You're going to have a big solar power plant. We've got one in North Caddo going in. We've got a huge one going in up in northeast Louisiana around Bastrop. We have another one at Faraday. So these things are coming. We want solar power. We want it because it's clean. We want wind power because it's clean. We certainly want natural gas. Like I told you, I have been very blessed. My house and place is in the middle of the Haynesville Shale. But there's room for all. But the big oil companies have had their day in Louisiana. They've owned the politicians, and we have not benefited well from all of their shenanigans. We know how to cure the problem, change the way we tax oil and gas, charge offshore oil coming through the state of Louisiana, get a fee out of it, raise the money. It is constitutional. Everybody will tell you, oh, it's not constitutional. It is constitutional as long as you treat people the same way from Louisiana all the way to Minnesota.
Well, Foster Campbell, we do have to roll. Always good to get your take on the world at large. We'll be calling again soon. And in our back half of the hour, we'll hear from two substantial authors, Femi Yuba, LSU theater professor, and Ace Atkins, former Auburn football star, now one of the top novelists in America. Back after this pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're joined by longtime LSU professor Femi Yuba. His book is Experiencing W.S., The Making of an Artist Scholar. W.S. is his mentor, and Femi Yuba is a native of Nigeria, but he has logged 32 years at LSU. He's been involved in over 30 theater productions, and we've known him locally, but he has quite a backstory to tell as well, and it's in all its glory. Experiencing W.S. from a major publishing house. This isn't one of those self-published books. It is something that is embraced by Austin Macaulay Publishers, London, Cambridge, New York. And good morning to you, Professor Yuba.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, tell us who W.S. is, first of all.
W.S. Was my mentor in Nigeria, Wole Soyinka. But it also implicates Shakespeare, the Bard of Stratford.
Yes. Well, how important was this person in your life?
Oh, very important, because first of all, I was a rookie actor, you know, to begin with, you know, learning theater, acting from him when he came back from Nigeria, from London. He came back from London in 1958, I think. And then from there, we started a theater company with him before I had left for London in 1962. And then I came back to Nigeria in about 76, and we collaborated again doing shows, you know, his plays mm-hmm. and some other plays.
One reviewer says, experiencing W.S. is a deeply engaging, exceedingly insightful, and well-written account of the experience and history of acting and directing since the mid-20th century. Its originality is manifested in every paragraph. Its cumulative impact creates a revolutionary path to the understanding of acting in post-colonial Africa. Its fabulous take on the mentor-mentee relationship is so compelling as to lead to an analytical framework on how to teach others. Professor Yuba has achieved what is hard to come by, a fact-based, rigorous, and sincere take on African theater situated within a rich historical context in order to understand the complexities of individual characters in their lived realities along with the politics and culture of watershed moments. This fascinating book will certainly hold the interest of the reader from the very first page to the last. Now, people are probably unaware that there is theater in Africa, but there is an abundance of it, isn't there?
Oh, there is an abundance of it. You know, people usually make that mistake. But if I can tell you that, you know, even indigenous drama had been going on even before Nigeria became independent, you know, in 1960. Indigenous theater, drama, in terms of ritual drama, you know, you find in theater companies that are sponsored by themselves, actually, you know. They're a family company that travel from mm-hmm. one city to another, you know, doing their shows in the vernacular in Nigeria.
Now,
people of color have advanced in Hollywood, although there are many miles to travel, but there has been advancement. How is it on the stage around the world, in the United States in particular? Do black people get a fair shake?
Well, that's still a problem. I think there are lots of actors right out there, and although I would caution that not everybody can be an actor because, you know, it's very steep, you know, going, you know. Not only even if you're talented, sometimes that doesn't really work, or it works for a long time. It doesn't work for a long time, especially when I was in England, you know. My coach used to tell me that, look, I know you're a talented actor, but, you know, it comes, you know, gradually. Right. And you have to, you know, just wait and let it materialize. Unfortunately, of course, I left England for the U.S. before I actually blossomed. Although before then I was doing some shows, you know, playing principal theater. I'm a principal characters, you know, in some of the plays. I was lucky. Really,
right. Well, you have been an actor and you've worked behind the scenes, as we know. Do you have a preference?
I have a preference. Now, because I stopped acting since 2002 with a production of an adaptation of Oedipus Rex. I mean, Oedipus at Colonus, adapted by right. My mentor, Wally Schoenker. But in terms of preferences, I think I like directing, really, now more than anything else. You know?
And you've done that in abundance in our community. How is this area for the kind of thing you do?
I think when I came in, it wasn't that good. But I think LSU has done tremendously well. And also there are some companies in New Orleans, for instance. Difficulty is that I don't think we have enough house for theater, you know, black theater, you know. There was one in the 60s and then it closed, you know. More recently, we have one or two in New Orleans, but not really. Right. You know.
Who are some of your favorite directors and actors that you have encountered?
I would say back in England, really. Directors like Bill Gaskell, for instance, who directed me, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Company, you know, in England. I've encountered actors like Alec Guinness, you know.
Academy Award winner.
And Simon Signore, you know. Right. I was in a show with them, Macbeth, you know. I was one of the witches, you know.
It's been quite an odyssey, and somebody from Lagos, Nigeria, doesn't usually end up in Baton Rouge for 32 years.
I know.
Something must have been compelling about this place for you.
Well, it happened by accident, actually. You know, again, through the effort of my mentor. I was at William & Mary for about 2 years. I came back to the U.S., you know, from Nigeria, looking for an entry, you know, especially in the universities. And one of my friends, you know, Henry Louis Gates Jr.,
right,
Skip Gates, helped me a lot, you know, in trying to find William & Mary. Before then, I was, of course, at Yale, you know, doing my master's in African American Studies. But also I did earlier on, you know, playwriting at Yale University. So he was the one that told me about Louisiana because I had only 2 years temporary, you know. But again, it happened at the time that my mentor was giving a lecture at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and Gates was there. He mentioned my name to them that, you know, I could be a very good addition to English department, and then to theater. So that's how I came. I did two interviews, actually, in Baton Rouge first for English, and then came back to do theater. So that's how I got there. And I didn't think I was going to stay long. And as it happened, you know, I was able to do what I really like to do.
Yeah.
You know, teaching, directing, you know, writing. You know,
and your students like you a lot.
I think so, especially my playwriting students. You know, yeah.
Experiencing WS, The Making of an Artist Scholar, the book from Femi Yuba, 32 years professor of theater at Louisiana State University. As far as the quality of the productions at Swine Palace and others locally, your thoughts about how good it is?
Yes, I have. I think Swine Palace especially has come about very well. You know, especially when Barry Kyle came into it, you know. And, of course, we had John Dennis, who was there directing right. shows. And I came into that, and the students were very, very, very active, you know. And I would say that there are lots of talents among the students. That's how you're able to actually direct them mm-hmm. and make the show, you know, a success.
What was the biggest adjustment, Femi, moving from Nigeria to the United States?
Luckily for me, I moved from London, actually, to the United States. I went to England about 1962, I went to the Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama, where I studied formal acting. And then I worked in the theater, London Stage, and somehow I wasn't content with just acting. I wanted to write some plays, which I had begun with the BBC radio plays, you know, really writing for them. You know. And then, again, by luck, I got admitted to Yale School of Drama to do playwriting.
Right.
So it was, and at that time when I came in, of course, you know, it was not a big adjustment. It's just a big adjustment from an English environment to an American environment, which I think probably was more competitive, you know, than in England. You know,
well, you've adapted well, and it's a story that is worth reading. Experiencing WS, The Making of an Artist Scholar. Dr. Femi Yuba, native of Nigeria, who has logged more than three decades in Baton Rouge at LSU. Thank you for joining us today. We will be back after this pause with another fabulous author, Ace Atkins, his latest in the Quinn Colson series. He'll talk about it when we return. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined by one of our favorite guests. He visits us every time he publishes a book, and he is one of the most prolific authors in the country. And before he became an accomplished novelist, Ace Atkins was a journalist who cut his teeth as a crime reporter in the newsroom of the Tampa Tribune, and that certainly set the stage for what was to come. He published his first novel, Crossroad Blues, at 27. And after Crossroad Blues, it was a world of his own, becoming a full-time novelist at the age of 30. At the Tribune, Ace earned a Pulitzer Prize nomination for a feature series based on his investigation into a forgotten murder of the 1950s that became a core of his critically acclaimed novel, White Shadow. He lives in a historic farm outside Oxford, Mississippi. He's a man who knows the South quite well, having played football for the undefeated Auburn Tigers in the year of 1993. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and he is back with The Heathens, his latest work, a Quinn Colson novel. And before we get to your latest work, Ace, your background, as I mentioned, has certainly been a catalyst for everything that has come since. Tell us about your early days as a reporter and how that formative time contributed to what we know now of Ace Atkins.
Absolutely. You know, I couldn't do what I'm doing now without the training. I think Hemingway said, you know, if you want to write novels, the best thing you could do is spend some time in a big city newsroom. And I was very fortunate to get hired on. I worked both for the St. Pete Times and also the Tampa Tribune, and learned so much just from editors there as far as, you know, the craft of writing and getting to the point and telling a good story. But also I came in contact with a lot of great stories that were funny and humorous, and some of them were heartbreaking and some of them were horrific. And over the years, you know, bits and pieces of those stories have found their ways into my novels. And certainly just the way that law enforcement works, the way that things actually happen in real life, that real life experience has been just a huge influence on me.
You have written now 28 novels, Quinn Colson in 11 of them, and this is another one, and we're going to talk about the heathens. But you know the South, you've lived in many parts of it, and you write about this region. What are some of the most vivid places you've been and lived?
Well, I think, you know, the Deep South has a particular special place for me. I'm originally from Alabama. My family is from Alabama from long ago, and I think that world is very seductive to me to write about, to return back to people that I know, and family members and family histories, and also at some point my father worked in the NFL, and I bounced around a lot as a kid. So I was born in Alabama and ended up going to high school in Alabama, but we lived other places. We lived outside the South. And it always feels like, you know, always felt like coming home to me. So I think these type of books are very familiar to tell. They're very familiar to explore. And I love, you know, every time I sit down and can go back to this fictional county in Mississippi, Tippecanoe County, it's always a pleasure to write. I get to play in this world. And that's a great deal of fun.
Your choice to live in Oxford, is that related to the region you're primarily writing about?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're asking me about the great places in the South that I visit. I mean, certainly, you know, God knows in Louisiana, I've spent a tremendous amount of time in New Orleans. There's part of this novel that actually takes place in Grand Isle. You know, there's a part of a chase that happens in North Louisiana. But yes, Oxford is a very special place, and it's, you know, what I feel, and I think many people feel, kind of a literary hub here. We've got, God knows, so many nationally known, well-known writers that work here. Almost all of them are my friends. You know, of course, there's the influence of William Faulkner is huge here. You can't go around the courthouse where, you know, I work right off the courthouse here on the town square. You can't help but be influenced by William Faulkner. So it's a very inspiring place to live. It's a great place to live and work for a writer.
Was a football player for a major power, and at the time an undefeated team, Auburn, 1993. You're accustomed to having thousands of people cheer you on or cheer against you. Writing is a much different occupation. John Ed Bradley has talked about this, who had a path similar to yours, and you're sure. It's a lonely world in many ways. How do you square the two, having had the adulation from thousands, and you may have adulation from even more people now, but you usually don't see and hear them.
It's a different thing, but I think it does put things in perspective. I think I've seen a lot of writers get out there where they get completely blown away by getting any type of attention, and it kind of can throw them off, where they get attention and they do book signings and all that kind of stuff, and it can kind of go to their heads. But I tell you what, from going to play in the SEC and having, you know, thousands of people cheer for you, it's a much smaller world when you get into the book world. I can tell you that. But I like it. I like the that's one of the perks of being a writer. I like the simplicity. I like I like being able to work on my own. I like setting my own hours. I like telling these stories. So, I have friends that have made their entire career out of football, including my own father. But I'm glad I don't have to deal with those pressures. I don't think there's any way that I ever considered going into coaching and that kind of thing, which a lot of my teammates did. But I'm very happy in my office here in Oxford.
How did your father influence you?
You know, my dad was a huge, he was an amazing guy. He was the MVP on the 1957 national championship team at Auburn, committed his whole life to football. He coached in the pros. And you know, what I really learned from my dad is, you know, whatever you do to, you know, to do your best, to be very disciplined in your work. You know, I don't know if I can say this on air. No, probably can't. But anyway, always work your hardest and never give a, I'll say half of an effort. He would phrase it in a different way, but half, always half give assed. Your best effort. That's it. That was his that was his favorite expression. Don't ever half-ass anything. And I always take that you know, that advice of always trying to get better, always trying to, you know, work on something. And you know, writing novels is very much like football in the fact of you know, the season comes and goes very quickly, and that season is over, and you have to get going on the next one. And so it was good prep for this world that I'm in.
Well, there are those. And there are more than a few who have read all of your books, the 11 Quinn Colson novels, and the latest is The Heathens, and you keep this character going, and one of the most vivid characters in American writing today. What is it about Quinn Colson that you believe is so captivating?
I think what Quinn represents, who he is he is a decent American hero, and I think he is a good moral compass. And I think even more so now than when I first started writing him 10 years ago is I think we need those kind of characters in popular fiction. And I think about, you know, as a kid, you know, that really resonated with me, not only people like, you know, Superman or, you know, the Lone Ranger, but, you know, like a character like Will Kane from High Noon that is, you know, the only guy who's standing up in the middle of corruption and hypocrisy and cowardice. And we are living in times that people are drawn to lies and to corruption and things that are, I feel, very anti-American behavior, anti-decency, maybe I should use that word. And I think it's always good to remind ourselves. I think that's what fictional characters and movie characters can do, is really represent the best of us. And I look at Quinn like an average Joe. He's not a Superman. He's not a super soldier. He doesn't really, you know, that's not where he comes from. But I think he's like an Andy Griffith. You know, he's a moral compass. Maybe a little bit of a harder edge than Sheriff Andy. But he's, I think it's important to have characters that we can follow and characters that you know, reflect the best of society. And especially as we've seen, where society and decency has been, you know, taking a hard hit these days.
Now you keep going with Quinn Colson, and it's a talent that you can keep him vivid and even more of a character than when you first started, as you said. But tell us about The Heathens, your latest work, and Quinn Colson's activities in this book.
Well, you know, it goes, you know, circles back to the first thing that you were asking me about is my newspaper days. And sometimes there were stories that I would cover that were very vivid and very made a huge impression on me, but I didn't write about them. I didn't immediately think to bring them into my fiction. And then, you know, 10 years later, something would, you know, set off of an idea that would be right for something in Tippahaw County. And not necessarily that I'm writing true crime or trying to recreate the people that I wrote about, but the story of this girl, Valesa Robinson, who's 14 and, you know, this was in Tampa, it was a national story, was accused of killing her mother, and that she had two male accomplices. That thing, I covered the trial, I covered some of the initial crime, and that thing had always stayed with me, and it was a big national news story. And I think what finally was, you know, the character in my novel, T.J. Byrd, is a very different character than Valesa was. Valesa grew up in a very nice house in Florida. She had a swimming pool. She had money. Her mother was was a successful lawyer. And T.J. is really kind of the opposite of that. But the catalyst for me was, what if these kids, Valesa was ultimately convicted of her crimes, and what if these kids were innocent? And so that's where this whole idea is. So what if a kid was accused, you know, a young girl, 17-year-old girl was accused of a horrific crime and nobody would listen to her. And so that was everything for this book.
Well, congratulations on keeping it going. The Heathens from Ace Atkins, the 11th Quinn Colson novel. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting.